This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice. Today, that first step into management and how not to stuff it up. Picture this, 800 employees all over the world and none of them in an official workplace. The world's largest employer of remote workers is a software company called Envision. Its employees work from home or cafes, wherever they want. Actually, and try not to hate them, three of the younger London-based employees recently rented a house in the south of France for a month and worked from there. Yep. The work they do is assisting other companies with the increasingly essential tools of digital design. Ryan Burke's the Vice President of International at Envision, and he's here in Australia for StartCon, a big startup conference at Sydney's Randwick Racecourse. Ryan, welcome. Your company has only ever had remote employees, hasn't it?
Yeah, we have. So from day one, we've been a remote company. And I think that's actually a big part of the reason why we're so successful with it, is because it's sort of ingrained in kind of our culture and our DNA. And so Clark Valberg, our CEO and founder, at the time was running a product design agency and built the Envision product as part of that. And when he wanted to start Envision, he wanted to find kind of the best engineering talent anywhere. And at the time in New York, Google was just opening up. And so they were sucking up a lot of the engineering talent. And so Clark wanted to be very selective and find talent, kind of the best talent anywhere. And that's sort of been part of who we are from day one.
I guess if you're starting something, you can't afford to pay what Google can afford to pay.
Yeah, exactly. We've got people all over the world now, and you can be very selective in the type of talent that you can get, and you don't have to deal with New York or Silicon Valley type salaries or even deal with sort of the competitiveness in a lot of cases. And so, you know, we've got talent in, I think, 27, 28 different countries around the world now.
If you've got the skills and you live in, I don't know, Kansas City,
yeah,
you can earn a lot more working for a company like yours,
exactly,
than you would otherwise in Kansas City, just not as much as you probably would earn if you're in Silicon Valley.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
It's a sort of arbitrage, isn't it? It's sort of on a personal level.
Yeah, a little bit. And you find people that are in different parts of the world for different reasons. And maybe they're there for a family reason. Maybe they're there for something else. And, you know, there's a lot of talented people in sort of different parts of the world that, you know, allows us to, you know, really kind of go after the best of the best.
And these are employees, aren't they? They're not contractors.
Yeah, they're not contractors. So these are all full-time employees of Envision. And so we are about 800 people now. Yeah, we've got predominantly North America is where the company started.
Yep.
But, you know, I'm over in London now for the past year, and we've got people all over Europe, and now we've got folks here in Australia as well.
Okay. You should probably tell me what Envision does, because yeah, I reckon many people listening now would not know.
Yeah, so the way to think about Envision is, you know, we help companies build better digital products and get them to market faster, right? So we are a design collaboration platform. So what that means is, you know, if you think of the Uber, Netflix, like a lot of the things that you're already using, maybe on your phone or, you know, on the web, those are products that in a lot of cases are being built using a product like Envision, right? We allow people to build rapid prototypes and then collaborate, right? Really the secret sauce is design is something that's relevant to every part of the business now. It's not just this team that sits in the corner and tries to make things pretty. It's part of the driving force of the business. And so what we do is we bring people into that design process. The product teams, the engineering teams, the marketing teams give you a vehicle and a platform to take that feedback up front before you finalize and go to code and spend a bunch of money and resources. And that's really been kind of the critical part for us, is bringing design to non-designers.
So this is about how it looks, but also how it works, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you think about sort of the pain point that we're hitting in the market today is, you know, our CEO founder likes to say that the screen is the most important place of the world, right? And that's without a doubt true. Like there's industries that are literally being won and lost now by the swipe of a finger. And so what we're doing is we're enabling companies where, you know, maybe they don't historically view themselves as a digital product company, but they have to be now. Every company has to be a digital product company, whether they like it or not. If they've got a website, if they've got a mobile app, like they're going to have to optimize those experiences because consumers are choosing what companies they're going to work with based on how they're interacting on the phone or the website or digital dashboard display in a car, it could be.
And what you're saying is it's not enough anymore for there to be a design department who would decide all this stuff.
Exactly.
and everyone else would just be told this is what it was going to be.
Yeah, exactly. And so now you need things that are both functional and fast, but also differentiated in terms of a customer experience and how they work and how they interact with the consumers. And that's what we really enable, is optimizing all of those digital touch points that companies have now, because you think about how many devices are there. Right? How many different ways do consumers have to interact with a particular brand? And that's what we really help companies do.
So who are you working with here in Australia? Because basically you don't work with the likes of me on my phone. You work with the companies I interact with.
Yeah. So we work with, you know, a lot of companies across the world right now. And if you think about Australia specifically, there's some really forward-thinking design companies like the Culture Amps or the Canvas of the world who are customers. Then you think about the banks that are all trying to, you know, mitigate disruption from some of the fintech startups like the ANZ banks. And those are folks that we work with as well. There's companies like Atlassian where they're a customer, but they're also a partner of ours. Right? They actually invested in Vision. And so we have a really close relationship with somebody like Atlassian, because if you think about, you know, they've got the engineer developer persona, and we work a lot with the designers. And like the marriage of the two, you know, their chocolate and our peanut butter together is really what's magic in the business world today, is how do you bring those two teams closer together? And that's what we can do working with somebody like Atlassian as well.
They're a good combination because, of course, they have been in that business of helping teams work together, even if they're not together.
Exactly. Which is part of our thing too, right? We're a fully remote company, but if you think about it, you know, part of what we solve is the ability to collaborate with people that you're not physically in the same room with. Like Envision inherently is a collaboration platform. And that's part of the reason that Clark, our co-founder, built it, is he wanted to get feedback from his customers and his clients very quickly, and they might not be in the room. And so we work with IBM and Google that have people all over the world. Collaboration is kind of part of our DNA. Yeah, yeah. And that's why, kind of from a remote perspective, it's who we are.
What are your employees make of it? Are they happy with this arrangement?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Our employee satisfaction is really high. I mean, Glassdoor ranked us one of the top places to work. There's a few things that I think we're really proud of. You know, our attrition actually for women is about 4%. And that's really, really low in the technology world.
That's losing 4% of your women a year, basically.
Yeah, basically. And the reason that we have such a low attrition is because, you know, we value things like family. Like, I walk my kids to school every day, right? And it's less about the work-life balance. It's more about the work-life integration. And so you have time to spend time with your children or whatever these, you know, key events are from a personal perspective. You can travel more. And, you know, we've got all sorts of different things that lead to, I think, an incredibly high engagement and satisfaction with the company.
But it's not easy to manage necessarily. No. I mean, there's going to be people listening now, and I reckon I'd be one of them, Ryan, who'd say, look, there's just no substitute.
Yeah, people can hide.
For being in the same room.
Yeah, definitely.
This is a better interview because I'm looking at you and you're looking at me.
Right, right.
It is.
But, you know, there's ways to look at each other, right? So we use, you know, from a collaboration and communication standpoint, you know, technology can address that, right? We use Zoom, we're on video calls all day. And, you know, we've got a digital whiteboarding product that's actually part of the Envision platform, where you literally have a pointer and I have a pointer. It'd be similar to you and I standing in a room with different colored markers and sort of brainstorming. Like, we can deliver that experience, you know, through the technology. I think the one thing is you got to double click a little bit more on the culture, right? That's a little bit harder to do.
Because that is, you know, me bumping into you and saying, let's get a coffee, or us knowing that on Wednesdays, this stuff happens at this place, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's tough as we scale. I mean, shoot, I started when there were 30 people, and it was a lot easier to collaborate, you know, remotely than now where there's 800, and you've got to invest in it. And so we've done a really good job of kind of scaling this remote culture. And there's things that we've learned from, like, you know, onboarding. Like, onboarding is really critical to double down on remote, right? People can be just first day of work, sitting at home, don't know who to talk to, right? That can be intimidating and scary. Maybe your computer's late, whatever. So we've really had to like revamp our onboarding program to help people feel like, you know, they're welcome, they know who to talk to, they know what to do. And then, you know, there's other things. Being part of a remote company, you got to learn to celebrate. You got to learn to do everything remote, because you can't do things in one city where there's a population in like London or New York where there's a lot of people at the expense of somebody that might be in Kansas City or Brazil or wherever. And so you've got to make sure that as a company that you're sort of true to the whole philosophy around remote.
Okay. Well, how do you do that? You have a great year.
Yeah.
You hit all your targets. You're exceeding your targets.
Yeah.
How do you say, okay, guys, we're going to do something. Yeah, we're going to celebrate it.
Yeah. I mean, we do some cheesy celebrations online. You know, we do some things that, you know, Halloween contests and stuff like that, where you can do things. There's a company out there called Bonusly that has sort of these micro rewards where basically everybody at the company gets like $30 or $50 a month. And, you know, if you or I were in a meeting and you crushed it, I could give you $3. And everybody in the company sees it. It goes in the Slack channel. And it's like that pat on the back that maybe you weren't able to give to somebody physically that everybody sees. And you should see our Slack channel for Bonusly. I mean, it's all day. Bum, bum, bum. $5, you nailed this. $3, you nailed that. And it adds up.
But it's not just the money, is it? It's those little bits of money. It's a little dopamine hit you get in your brain.
That's exactly what it is. Exactly what it is. And then, you know, there's other things that we do where, you know, we'll do MTV style cribs and have people show what their office environment looks like, you know, at home, because you've got crazy situations where people, you know, some people work, and then we do a lot to invest in it as well. So everybody that starts at the company, they get $500 to set up, you know, their home office. Maybe they need a new chair or a monitor. Everybody has a coffee card that resets every month, $100 a month, where we know inevitably people are going to be working in coffee shops. So we want to incentivize that and help people with that. So $100 a month. So there's little things like that. And then there's, you know, culturally, I mean, I think you saw the BBC where the guy was on the, and his kid came in and he's like trying
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah.
Because so, now my kids are teenagers, so they're in their rooms. Yeah. If I go looking for them, I probably won't see them. Unless I'm in the way of the refrigerator.
Right, exactly.
But when they were little, if I'd worked from home, it would have been a bit touch and go.
Yeah, it can be. But the thing is that because we're remote, you have to kind of welcome that, right? You know, we encourage that. If your kid walks in, like, introduce them to people on the call, right? That's part of who we are now, is like, it's more than just your work. You know, if we're going to be having people work from their home and be part of their personal lives, like, that should be celebrated and included as well. And I think people really respect that.
Okay. So I want to come back to the digital design bit. Are you having more success in winning the argument? Because this has been a process, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Design is gradually getting more important. Perhaps it's speeding up.
Yeah.
But at the board level, you're getting the traction or?
Yeah, you're starting to, because if you think about the board level, you know, one of the issues historically with design has always been like, what is the financial value? What's the commercial value of something? Oh, you made that look good. Great. What does that mean? Right. But now designers are actually helping to do things like get products to market faster. They're helping to design products that increase in conversion rate, that drive up an NPS score. And like, those are board level metrics that big companies worry about. And so now design's getting a seat at the table, but you can start to see the trends. I mean, chief design officers, other than sort of in the hardware world, didn't really exist 10 years ago. And now you look at these chief design officers that are being brought in all over the place, or you're seeing the, you know, kind of the evolution of things like design systems, big, you know, investments to help drive efficiencies in design and development, really. And those are board level investments now. And so they're starting to get, you know, more awareness and acceptance there. And, you know, we're a big kind of evangelist of that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Ryan Burks, the Vice President of International at InVision. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. So you've been promoted, possibly for the first time, into a management role, and suddenly your relationships with the peers are different. It'd be easy to get it wrong if you misjudge things and move too quickly. Hays, the global recruiting firm, has some advice that applies to new middle managers in particular. And basically it's three broad points. So go slowly at the start, reassess your goals and let go of what you used to do so well in your previous role, and one of the trickiest, set boundaries with your peers, who are often your mates. Lisa Morris joins us from our Adelaide studio. She's an operational director of Hays. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thank you.
So why is this so particularly pertinent to middle managers?
I think really this is the first rung on that step of leadership and separating yourself potentially from a peer group for the very first time. So you're in new territory, and I think that for some people at this level it can be a little bit daunting. And the fact is it's new, so there's a lot to be learned.
Yeah, and actually for both you and formerly your mates, it'd be easy to imagine that things are more or less still the same, but they're not still the same, are they?
No, they're not. It's a tricky territory to navigate, and in my years of being in management myself, I've seen it be managed particularly well by individuals and then not so well, and the effects can be quite damaging for internal relationships.
Yeah, and some of those people may have applied for the role you've got.
Yes, and again, sometimes that's transparent and you'll know who those individuals are, and other times you won't. So, as I said, it's quite tricky. But, I mean, really, the point here being is just take your time with trying to reassess some of these boundaries with your old peer group, but also, just as importantly, your new peer group. So you're kind of navigating two groups here.
Yeah.
Those that you have been working with who, like you say, may have been your mates, you may have worked with for a really long time, you have common ways of working with each other that have become very normal for both of you. It is an adjustment for both. And I think that a good manager will have a sense of that. It's an adjustment for yourself, but it's also an adjustment for the people that you've been working with. And they may need a little bit of time to be able to, get used to how the new way of interacting with you is going to work for you and them.
Because the point is they are going to be interacting with you. This is not like you have gone from where you were to off to the C-suite. You are now in the middle of it. You're in
Absolutely.
That middle management thing where it's not just overseeing from a distance. It's operational. You're working with them.
And you're still in the troops and you're one of the team, but you've been elevated to now lead that team. And like you say, you're not in the C-suite, so you're not completely removed. You still need to have those really healthy, workable relationships. You'll more than likely be interacting on a daily basis, but that level of interaction will be somewhat different. So, yeah, taking time and being quite firm and, if necessary, a little bit assertive with what those new boundaries might look like.
Okay, well, let's unpack a bit more of the do's and don'ts.
Sure.
Because one instinct might be to get stuck in and make the changes that you said you would in an interview when you got the job. Because let's face it, in nearly every industry now, change management is sort of the thing. And you've probably been asked what you would change if you got the role.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. And it can be a natural urge to just dive headfirst and ride in and feel like you've got to deliver really quickly on what it was that the new role was described to you as and what you promised in interview, as you say. But it can be, first of all, difficult for the people that you're working with. You may come up short because if you jump in without due thought and consideration and really being a little bit more strategic about what it is that you're trying to achieve, you're likely to undersell yourself in those opportunities, and you may not get that first opportunity again in somebody's views and opinions of you. And some people will be a little offended by you jumping straight in and taking on perhaps something that they have felt they've had ownership over in the past themselves. So the advice being to just take a little bit of a step back, feel your way through those new relationships and try to determine what the lay of the land is, both your new relationships, your past relationships, and those you may not even be aware of that are stakeholders in your new role, and really just think through methodically what it is that you need to do and plan that out so that you are actually achieving the things that you said you were going to achieve through the process of interviewing. And that may mean that you've got to have relationships with your new boss, your peers, your new stakeholders to agree on what those timeframes may look like.
All right. Well, that kind of gets us to the next thing, doesn't it? So reassessing your goals.
Yeah.
And this is the hard bit, it seems to me, letting go of what you used to do really well, probably, in your previous role.
Yes. Yeah, very hard, because there's been more than likely a sense of validation that's come from those things that you used to do in your role. And they're probably the things that you were doing that had you received recognition in the first place, which probably contributed to you being promoted. So that in itself requires, you know, again, a step back and really assessing, are these tasks part of my new remit of responsibilities? And are they the things that are going to continue to have me recognised for doing a good job in this new role? Or are these things that I have been doing and doing well now something that I need to be investing in developing in my team and delegating perhaps? That's one part of it.
And of course, as part of this, and in fact, part of what we were just talking about before, about delivering what you said you'll deliver, but doing it in a reasonable time frame rather than trying to do it all over in a month, is going to be talking to people and perhaps talking to people slowly, one by one.
Mm-hmm. And really, the one-on-one conversations should be more listening, less talking, I would suggest, particularly in the first few weeks, months, as you're getting a really good understanding as to which roles your people are playing and who the influencers are, who potentially the blockers to, you know, you moving forward on a particular project may be. And you can only get a sense of that over time as you're reassessing some of those dynamics of the people that you're working with, but then setting out what your agenda might be. I would say that after a couple of months, you'd certainly be wanting to be in a position of demonstrating what it was that you have been spending your time on, and clearly there would need to be some outcomes on that.
Now, the third of those points, of course, is about the people who used to be your peers.
Mm-hmm.
You're now their manager.
Yes.
How do you, you've had your conversations, but you are now in a different role, but you may have had personal relationships with those people.
Yes.
How do you navigate that?
I think by continuing to be real and connecting with people and being authentic and continuing to maintain the things that formed the basis of your relationships in the first instance. I don't think that you can change your personalities overnight. You know, you certainly can't change and become a totally different person or change the way you're going to interact with people in a significant way and expect those relationships to continue without any hiccups. But having said that, I think being really transparent with those people to say, look, you're part of my team. This is a shift for both of us. This is the direction that I think we need to be moving toward. This is certainly the direction that the role has of me, but I'm interested to hear from you. How do you think we can make this work together? And I think certainly in my experiences, I've found most people respond well to a really open and transparent conversation where they feel like that they are being heard and listened to and that their views and opinions are being taken on board, but not always. And particularly where that individual may have been up for the job and may be quite disappointed or may have their own views on who should have won that role. Whatever the difficulties may be, if there are those, then they certainly need to be addressed. I don't think that it's healthy to continue on and pretend that those things can just be overlooked and it will go away, because it likely won't. So, you know, setting boundaries,
yes,
it may call for being assertive. It may call for being quite clear around what your expectations are of that individual if they don't seem to be coming on board with your direction.
I'm glad you said that. I was just thinking it's just so easy. I think we've all seen it where you've got people and their colleagues and they've got a relationship that my son, who's an 18-year-old, would describe as having lots of banter, which is basically winding each other up and things like that.
Mm.
Now you're the manager, it's kind of not appropriate anymore. You've got to find a way of making that clear.
Yeah, I think there's a time and a place. I think that is it okay for you to be having, you know, a good time and relaxed relationships in moments? Yeah, I think it is, but you've got to pick what those moments are. And again, if the promotion has been one which was unexpected, there hadn't been some framework laid down beforehand, there hadn't been a natural evolution of somewhat of a separation over a longer term, then that's going to be more challenging. I find, however, that those people who are on the progression toward middle management are likely to have been laying some of those foundations prior to that promotion being officially announced, potentially. And therefore, my suggestions, you know, would be even before you're being promoted, start shifting those relationships and start considering how you're going to pull apart from the pack and how are you going to elevate yourself. And there's subtleties in that. It is about just walking away from a conversation sometimes if it's seeming to be, you know, that little bit too much banter that you perhaps shouldn't be involved in. Or considering, you know, how your personal brand is being represented as either one of the pack or as a potential future leader or a newly promoted middle manager.
Lisa, lots to think about there. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Lisa Morris is Director of Operations for Hays in South Australia and the Northern Territory. We're nearly finished, but next week, a remarkable story of getting back to work after an injury. Here's David Nugent.
I was cleaning out around Baylor and I was both my arms, firstly my right and then my left arm, were pulled into the baler in a very confined part of the baler.
So you lost an arm and part of the other, is that right?
I lost my right arm through surgery in the following 6 hours, and my left arm had an enormous amount of surgery over the period of 5 months while I was in hospital to keep the blood supply to it and hopefully maintain the survival of it on my body.
They are obviously very severe injuries. What was involved in your rehabilitation?
Engaged a rehab provider And from there, the rehab provider helped map out a plan through physiotherapy, a movement of my limb where possible to try and get some recovery in motion and movement. And from there, as it progressed, reintroduction into work.
I hope you can join me for that. Best Practice is produced by Anne Arnold and Georgia Power. Our sound engineer is David Lawford. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.